Carbondale, Carbondale, Monongahela. Oh, well, I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. I crossed the atmosphere, man. I beat them out of here, man.
We're going to introduce ourselves. I'm Jordy Comis, producer for Barnstorming PA. I wear a lot of different hats. And this week, I think I'm going to be wearing the fact that I'm on the board for UU Justice PA, which is Unitarian Universalists working on changing policy towards our values. Dwayne.
Hi, I'm Dwayne Heisler. My day job is working with SEIU Healthcare PA. We're a healthcare union who represents healthcare workers in nursing homes and in hospitals and home healthcare workers. But on my spare time, I'm the chair of the Democratic Progressive Caucus for the state of Pennsylvania. And I'm also on the executive committee for the state Democratic Party, in addition to being involved with several local progressive organizations. Sam.
I'm Sam Pearson. I am by day a... the Elm Street manager do neighborhood revitalization in Lewisburg with Lewisburg Neighborhoods, and also do a variety of volunteer work, whether it's around sustainability, transportation, gun safety, racial justice, et cetera.
Kind of all the progressive issues, it sounds like, Sam.
I have my pet list, and yeah, I think I try to cover everything. I'm not heavily involved in actually LGBTQ or feminism, but all issues are the same issue. So therefore, I have it covered.
And then my name is Nathan Lund. I'm a political consultant who works in Harrisburg, and where Sam kind of misses on the LGBTQ stuff, I can make up for it just because I'm gay myself and existence is resistance in some sense. I'm a bit of a community activist and generally just a guy trying to figure things out. So hopefully we can do some of that today.
I mean, that speaks to me, Nathan. And I'm really enjoying having you, you know, as part of our regular set of people, because we keep finding these sort of deep, they feel almost spiritual connections. Like we were talking on the phone about this book that, and I don't remember now the title, but it's like How to Make a Difference or something, but it's this book by Elizabeth Shore that is one of these books that I'm like in my head, like it's interesting because real quick, it's about how, what kinds of social service programs really work. And it's stuff that like still seems obvious. And the book I think is kind of out of print, and it's like, it's an example of lessons we don't need to keep learning, right? Like we know what works. We just usually have execution problems. And then Nathan was like, I have that book on my shelf. And I was like, no way. So in terms of the figuring out when I grow up, you know, I mean, I still am trying to be a Jedi when I grow up. I think that, you know, that's the career path that eludes me.
You could pick a worst value system. So that's pretty good.
Well, it also has the hallmarks of a great religion, which is lots of built-in ambiguity.
True.
Longtime listeners may know that we often start with a headline of the week. We discovered in our pre-meeting writing room that the headline for the week is passing the buck. none of us really quite had one, but that's fine. It feels like we just did this yesterday. This show, I don't know, are other people feeling weird time distortions with COVID time?
Yes.
That could also relate to the headline for the week, which is, you know, if anyone read Dave Barry's year in review, which was very cathartic, there are new months in it, so you should check it out.
That's good.
And we are in one of them right now. So
which one is that? Do you remember?
Pandemic. Post, we're in the period after his deadline, and he's like, I have no idea what's going to happen, which is not usually an issue. And that yet this year, so actually being in this condition right now, I think is a little bit unusual, because usually you are at loose ends and it doesn't really matter. And this year, everyone has this nagging suspicion that something huge is happening, because that's what we've been conditioned to all year. I also do want to, even though I don't have a good headline, I do want to mention that the theme for the week, I think, should be statistics. we're still bad at them. And like people in particular, look, numbers are plummeting over the holiday weekend. And it's like, are you out of your mind? That's called a reporting anomaly. And now they're all going to be freaked out about how high they're going to go for COVID, for example. And it's just going to be like, 7-day averages, let's just work on 7-day averages and no one tell people about the daily report like for a week, because we're going squirrel when we should be paying attention to ducks.
You know, that's so interesting, because like combining those like is meaningful for me. I think March was originally like the first month of the year, wasn't it? And then they added like January and February, and January is like Juno, right? The deity that has two faces, the one that looks backward and the one that looks forward. And the idea of statistics, like, yeah, that's amazing, Sam. I just heard something else. I was just on one of the television news programs as I was walking by, and I had it on silent, and I read the caption that said, at our current rate of vaccination, it would take the United States 10 years to vaccinate everyone. So, you know, failure again. And then I was reading an article from, The Economist. I don't know where it was, but that we're something like 43rd or 46th in terms of genomic testing, and like behind all these other nations in knowing whether or not we have new variants of the strain. I mean, the genome should be like our, like, that's our core. Like we help to map that shit, right? Like, and we are so behind on it. Just like, if there's a way for us to do it wrong, we can certainly figure it out. That's my headline. I don't know.
Yeah. And does anyone remember when we had big ideas? It sounds like a throwaway callback, but like in the Obama administration, we were supposed to be working on mapping the whole brain, right? And then like we did hear about it for a little while, but then you get a new administration and it's like it just fell off. And it's like that's not what we should be striving for. We need to be innovators, right? And it's weird, because I love this country a lot, right? And I'm actually very proud to be an American, which is weird in some like leftist spaces, right? Sometimes that'll get you a lot of flack, but I do. I think that there is a lot of opportunity. And I think sometimes we downplay the issues in other places. But at the same time, it's hard not to feel nostalgic when you look back and you see like this soaring rhetoric and then actually actions that back it up. And you see just the complete dearth of that these days. And it makes you question, where did we go wrong and how do we get that back?
Yeah, I love how we're actually doing our headline of the week, even though we said we weren't. But I definitely, in the last 2 weeks, had a couple of moments that that I feel like are that like proud to be an American. And I totally agree with you, Nathan. Like, I'm happy to say that, but I want to, you know, I always want to redefine it. And America, you know, loving America is it's not. I think we did this once, even on this podcast, Wayne. Right? It's not. I don't know if you were on that one, but it's not like a kind of puppy dog love that you can do no wrong. It's like a deep love of like knowing all of the faults and wanting it to be better. You know. But real quick, I just saw like two different things. One was like some news clips of Corning scientists making the glass for the vials, and it was so You know, those fiber or whatever those are, those suits with the face plates and pouring out this molten stuff, and you're like, hell yeah, we make shit. And then also like all the logistics, right? And the plane companies and the other companies. And it's like, it reminded me of when, you know, the best of a capitalist economy can get aligned. And also in the last 20 years, we've learned how to do something is to fucking track a package. Right. So it was like this kind of like D-Day, everyone coming together moment that I think we have been hungry for. And the big idea is, you know, this last thing I'll say is, and maybe this is a headline, is like our horizons keep shrinking. You know, a lot of us are in our homes or are not, don't have the privilege of being able to stay at home, you know, or having to go to work to feed families and other things. But it's just sort of everything is just keeps constricting, right? Like our horizons keep restricting. And even to the numbers, Sam, you know, people are focused on the day to day when it's the 7-day average of what you were saying, Dwayne, you know, the vaccination rate, like that's that number thing. What people miss is we can accelerate that. I feel like a lot of people don't understand that a static number is not, you know, they're not understanding that that could accelerate. And so, you know, we're probably, I hope, going to accelerate the vaccinations. But, you know, when you say that, I'm like, that doesn't mean a lot, because I assume we're at the beginning and it's going to accelerate.
Well, it's also it. This is a good reminder, like, of about optimism. I think, you know, we had actually, I think we're not going to talk about cabinet picks this week either, but
we are not.
That was the one thing I had actually prepared for. But one of the things just meta about that was reminding myself, oh yeah, competence. Oh yeah, we can dream big. Like instead of 4 years of being beaten down by all the worst decisions, all the worst people, like just, you know, people destroying things right and left, clearly on purpose. And it was like, oh wait, these are opportunities. There is so much potential again. And that was a great reminder. And I think the vaccine distribution is a perfect place. Like, you know, the current administration is like, we have a plan. And the incoming administration is like, that's not a plan. Like, there is no plan. There's nothing there. And that's actually a relief. Like, I feel like, you know, it's not just, we are the cavalry, right? But we're arriving, you know, and we're going to get to start doing things the way they should be done.
That's really one part of it, though, too. Like and it's a huge part. You know, I see two really big chunks, and I'm sure it can be like subdivided and more added too. But one is that we've had a federal government that has pretty much been a hands-off policy towards the coronavirus. I think we can all, you know, there's so much data out there that we can all agree upon that. But the other part is what happens when you run a for-profit health system, right? And where do resources get put? And if those two elements were different, I could actually see a positive United States actually leading the world in pulling us out of a pandemic instead of being fucking 43rd or 46th in genetic testing and that it would take us 10 years at our current rate of vaccine. Like, did we learn nothing from testing, which was a debacle and continues to be, like that we couldn't roll out vaccinations in a different fucking way? I mean, seriously, people are dying.
I have 2 points that I think kind of sum this up for me anyways. And one of them is just that I always think of America as more of a project than a place. So like when we're talking about all these different things, it's just like we are contributing to that project to make America better, right? Like it's not about making it great again. It's about just making it better because it can be better. And then the other point is Jordy was mentioning how like being an American, being a patriot isn't about handling the government with kid gloves and saying that they can do no wrong. And I always think of it as the reverse. People think that being on the left is looking for a paternal state, right? And I think of it more like we're the parents and we have to keep those kids in control. And if you want to keep your kids in control, you don't give them everything they want. And you have to be stern with them sometimes. So I think it's important to call out the government just like you would tell your kid, no, you cannot do that. And we need to tell the government more often that they need to do more things like roll out vaccines better, maybe. Otherwise, they're not going to get their allowance.
Yeah, no, that's great. A couple of little show notes. One thing is for my co-hosts, you should know we are going to move to putting these up since we're on Zoom on YouTube. So I know, note to myself to stop picking my nose so much. Unless, you know, somebody in the audience is really into that. I gotta say, look on Dwayne's face.
Oh my God, you should just like not do that. Whether the camera's on or off, Jordy, honestly.
No,
what does
look,
that say?
No, look, honestly, who's going to say they've never have a need to pick their nose? You don't have to answer that, but yeah, so, Nathan.
I actually, weirdly enough, I have something to say on this, and it's that, did you know that evolutionarily, there's a benefit to, there's like an instinctual benefit to picking your nose, and not only that, but also eating it, because it helps to, it helps with like allergies. It helps to prevent them because generally what gets stuck in your nose does it. So like you can almost inoculate yourself to it. So I'm not advocating for that, and I'm not going to admit why I know that. That's something evolutionarily. I just looked it up for no reason.
Nathan,
I am sending snot rockets your way. So just yes.
Be
prepared. I have allergies, so I've not been doing it right.
Yeah. All I want to say, Nathan, is welcome home. You have found the right place.
Thank you.
Anyway, this Sunday, January 3rd, is the Hub for Progress is having a summit called Progress Runs Through the Rural Patchwork. And you can find information at bit.ly, if you know that, bit.ly/no capitalization or punctuation Hub HUB 2021 summit. one of the reasons I bring that up, first of all, Sam, Dwayne, and I are all facilitators for the Hub. So there's a lot of overlap between Barnstorming and the Hub, although it's the one is not in any way beholden to the other. And one of the things that the main things that the Hub for Progress does is to help create spaces, by which I mean conversation spaces, sometimes physical spaces, to build more capacity for rural progressive organizing in our area. And that's about building different kinds of infrastructures often, you know, the human infrastructures of how people are connected, communication infrastructures, those kinds of things. So this summit is, we discovered last year, it was like serendipity at its best, that the Sunday after New Year's seemed to be a sweet spot to bring together different kinds of engaged leaders, organizers, anybody who feels that calling or aligned to that space. So this year, one of the main things we're going to do, and we're going to use this part of the podcast to kind of frame and reflect a little bit, but it's about looking back at the 2020 election. And I'm going to say that I think there's three kind of big questions that I think matter for both for analysis, but also for analysis that informs thinking of strategy and tactics and actions and plans. So one is literally what happened. You know, there's not an election, of course. There's hundreds and thousands of elections across the country happening simultaneously for different offices. And I was saying earlier, because of where our elections happen and then Thanksgiving and winter holidays and all of that, I usually feel like I never get enough of a chance to even look back at what happened. And I think there's also an awful lot of, especially by the larger media forces, there's kind of a rush to put a frame on what happened often before the best data has come in. And then that kind of has an outsized effect on how we collectively talk about and understand elections. So that's the first thing, what happened. The second thing, it is clear from what happened that, you know, Biden and the Democrats won the White House and didn't do well other places. In Pennsylvania, we didn't win the treasurer or the auditor general races, the Pennsylvania General Assembly. I think we now know that the Senate picked up one seat or held steady. And on the House side, Democrats lost, I think, three seats when they were hoping to maybe flip one or both chambers. So that's the second one. And the third big question is, what are some of the larger trends? I'll say I was in sort of gearing up for this. I was listening to a little bit of 538, which often I think is a useful podcast. I think it's unhealthy to obsess about polls too much. But I also know that they have a lot of expertise. So it's an interesting for me to kind of look in. But one thing one of them was saying, and I agree with this, is that often people don't pay enough attention to the large structural questions. And he said this thing that I'd love to find out. He said something like the median partisan advantage for a Senate race. So if you were to look at all the Senate races in the United States and you were to look at sort of the prognostications, the median Senate race is about plus six Republican, which is another way of putting a number on the fact that we know that the Senate is structurally stacked to Republicans. Well, that's a big margin. All of us have done a lot of work on campaigns. 6 points is a big margin to overcome. And so all of the sort of back and forth and the horse race style of politics, I think, in the United States doesn't really pay enough attention to that. So that was his point. So those are the big, big themes. So I've spoken a lot, so I'll just lay out a couple of things, or maybe we can kind of go around the horn. I mean, for you, what were some of the major just what happened in the election?
One of the things that I noticed a lot of was just the capacity for world building in politics is flabbergasting. The idea that you can have a separate reality within the same country and how that can prevent people from talking to each other, and how I've always been really strictly in favor of the freedom of speech, and yet I'm questioning some of it as far as media goes, just because I don't know that we wouldn't benefit as a society if we didn't have more regulations on what goes on our airwaves, especially when you look at some of the lies and some of the effects of those lies, like people being drummed up to violence at this point, to where people are trying to break into voting centers and stuff like that. It's frightening.
I would say, like I have like five very specific things that address, you know, the down ballot losses that that we had.
Could you pause on that, Dwayne, and we'll come to that in a sec?
Yeah, I'm not going to talk about.
Sorry.
I'm going to talk about, like, I have very specific things, but they're all related to how we talk to each other. It's about our messaging. And so my big takeaway is that, you know, that that we have to consider how we communicate with each other. And, you know, what you just said about the Senate, too, that's not about what the people really want, because if you look overall, it's not what we want. It's about how we choose to organize ourselves in states and how we choose to organize the Senate with each state gets two. And so it's really about counting how many conservative states you have, not really counting the will of all the people in the country. And it's designed like that on purpose. And so it should be no revelation that it's, what did you say, plus six? Like, mm-hmm. It's somewhere in the middle, because that's the math that we created. You know, that's not the feelings of the people. When you look at popular vote, that undoes all of that. You know, that's something else. But yes, I would say it's about our messaging. And I'm looking forward to going into some detail about the down ticket, down ballot disasters that we had, or the dash of hope that we had, I should say. It wasn't disaster, but the dash of hope we had.
Well, and I think I would want to point out that, you know, going back to a sort of, you know, we're you're asking us to dredge up potentially touchy topics, clearly touchy topics.
Very on brand for me, if you know me.
But for example, the whole question about whether defund the police or Black Lives Matter and how that was an issue or not. And my answer to that would be, it was both necessary and good and bad at the same time. And it was good because we need to talk about these things, and these are critical issues, and Black people are being killed, and we need to stop that. But it was also bad because it was taken advantage of. It was an opportunity that people saw to turn to their own, on the other side, to turn to their own ends. It doesn't mean that fundamentally those were not the topics to talk about and critical things to approach, but it does mean that they were exploited, twisted, and and wielded, I think, destructively. So I think that played out in Pennsylvania, because Pennsylvania is this array. It's not fully red. It's very purple. And so we had, and we, as we know, throughout the year, we had, you know, BLM, you know, protests happening all over the state. And yet we basically brought tension. You know, we sort of brought out also counter protesters who were armed, unmasked, you know, we brought out sort of the worst in people. I think of it as akin to lancing a boil, and we're currently like just still we're not quite festering, but it's an open wound.
So clearly this is the disgusting body fluids episode.
Yes.
I really think America's a Project, Not a Place is a better title, but we can go with nose picking and boil lancing as an alternate title, Sam. Nathan, did you
bring up both of them?
Oh, that's true. That's true. That's fair. Here are a couple of things, and I'm just going to rattle them off, anyone can respond to any of them. I was joking earlier, but I think I am a little bit now in a space of trying to pull out things that maybe people don't want to talk about, or I'm not even 100% sure I agree with these. I'm trying to push the conversation. But one is, it was a tie. Right. 2016 and 2020 at the presidential level were essentially ties. And what I mean from that, if you understand or study any sort of probability or statistics, but like the margins were so close that if we were to rerun the election many times, it could have gone a different way. And I think that fact that it's essentially a tie is at odds with the incredibly powerful narrative making processes, institutions we have, whether it's ourselves or the media. And that's compounded by the fact that we have a winner takes all system where we're like, Biden won. And then we immediately kind of erase how close it was in all kinds of places. And in Pennsylvania, Biden did win by a pretty small margin. I don't remember. Is it 120 or 130,000 votes? I know it was 44 in 2016. And it was larger for Trump. So that's one point.
It was almost double the amount. It was over 80,000.
Okay.
You know, Pennsylvania is very much like the United States. If you look even geography wise, like you look at our East Coast, we have Philadelphia, we have the Lehigh Valley, we have Monroe County, all those kind of went blue, right? More blue. And even on the West Coast, we have Pittsburgh, right? We have Harrisburg in the South. It's almost like, and then we have all the middle that's red, you know, that may have moved more blue or moved more red, you know, however that moved. And in fact, maybe even Scranton could be our like Chicago or some shit like that. But it's weird because like we have, it once again plays itself out just like America plays itself out.
For
and
sure.
If you look at our counties, it's the same
right.
way.
Right.
Our counties are the same way. We right. have more conservative counties than we do progressive right. counties. But more people live in the progressive counties.
I agree with you, Dwayne. And I feel like another theme is that, you know, in an era where map making and visualization of data is so easy to do. So well, there's more of that than there would have been in an earlier era. This relates to gerrymandering, but also relates to how we understand the political reality. But anyway, you know, maps reveal and obscure at the same time, I think. And I'm sure that geographers probably have said it's an interesting thing. But, you know, those pictures of counties, you know, you can see Luzerne and Lackawanna where Scranton Wilkes-Barre went for Biden. But if you were to go another level of granularity and looked at cities versus truly rural places, it's the opposite, right? So really it's cities within rural counties that are making the difference, probably. So a second thing I'm going to say that happened was that, and this one, you know, maybe is going to like rub some people the wrong way, but it, you know, like in my mind, I was thinking about this and leading up to the election, the protect the results period afterwards that all of us were deeply involved in to now, I think it, you know, there was a lot of emphasis on saying that like the dancing mailboxes in Philly, the protests in Harrisburg, all of that's what won. And actually, I think that the joy to the polls and protect the vote, it protected the outcome. But in Pennsylvania, the victory was not in Philadelphia, right? I mean, if you look at the numbers, that's just true. And in fact, it's highly variegated. It varies, as Dwayne was saying. And I know the one map I've looked at more carefully, a lot of counties in the middle part of Pennsylvania, in the eastern part, were where Biden overperformed compared to Clinton, also Pittsburgh, but there are a lot of other places. And so there's not a Philly and Pittsburgh won Pennsylvania. That is in fact incorrect, but that's also something that may be hard for some people to hear. Like they want to believe, I think some people who are engaged in talking about the Democratic Party want to say that it's the young, urban, multicultural vote base that won this election. And that's not necessarily true. Like they were absolutely essential, but it, you know, when you look at where the wins happened, it wasn't in Pittsburgh did better than 2016, but Philly didn't. So let me say one other thing. Exit polls, and I haven't heard people talking about this as much, but they really are pointless. So many people did mail-in voting. And so we, you know, I think that that's relevant, but also it means we, you know, I see a lot of people saying, well, you look at this vote total, and then you look at the vote total for Biden in Pennsylvania, and then you look at how many votes Torsella, who ran for treasurer, got, and there must have been split ticket voting. And I'm like, well, you don't actually know that. You know, all you have are the raw numbers. We don't know which people voted which way. And typically exit polls, from my understanding, would be a way to get at that. But because there's a systematic prejudice in the numbers, because if you did any exit polling in Pennsylvania or even after the fact polling, we consistently more and more polls undersample the people who are the Trump base.
So we've kind of hit two of the five things on our list that we're saving to talk about later. Oh. Right. So are we there yet? Are we?
Sure. Go for it.
Okay. So, Sam, absolutely right. The whole narrative about defund the police, you know, was something that was troublesome. It was hard. It was difficult. We had progressive organizations and individuals contacting each other all the time saying, how do we talk about this? This isn't right, blah, blah, blah. And you can't tell me, like, when we started to see a pivot to everyone putting up those thin blue line signs, you know, the support the police, you cannot put one of those up and not be thinking about race. So just let that soak in for a moment. You cannot be putting up one of those support the police signs in this era, in the past year, and not be thinking about race. That is a racist dog whistle.
And right? real quick, and then I'll throw it back to you, Dwayne. I was canvassing in Wilkes-Barre and in Scranton. And if people don't know, those are two cities and counties next to each other that on paper seem very similar. But in Scranton, there were we love the police. We stand with Scranton police signs everywhere. And in Wilkes-Barre, there were hardly any. And no one could tell me. But, you know, that's the kind of thing you notice when you're in neighborhoods by foot. Something was going on there about that messaging. And it was played way more in Scranton.
And we know that when you see messages or hear messages over and over again, it becomes common sense. That was a tool that was used by our opposition to engage with, you know, with those people who said, you know what, maybe Trump is racist, but I'm going to support the police. And they didn't realize, because that was actually stoking the fear and the resentment underneath, just barely underneath the skin of racial tension. That's what that was all about. Racial hatred, racial fear. That's what that was all about. And so that was something that had an impact. Obviously had an impact. People were putting up those signs in their yard as opposed to those overt political ones, right? And they're still up, right? You know, there, and in fact, there's some signs going up right now that say fuck Biden. They're all over. They're starting to pop up. So be ready for that, right?
I've not seen any of those.
Oh yeah, yeah. There, yeah.
The one thing is, linguistically, that is not as strong a phrase as fuck Trump, because of the the assonance of having that central U repeated.
I feel like that's the sort of quirky value added that you don't get on any other podcast.
Well, that's why the Scottish are particularly good at coming up with like really amazing curses, because they have down the repetitive use of internal vowels.
I'm going to throw it to Nathan in a second. We'll say that Elijah, who's our intern, is very interested in linguistics. And so if he wants to come off here and throw down about cursing, feel free. But go ahead, Nathan.
The one thing that I wanted to say is that when it comes to Black Lives Matter and talking about it and the way that like the backlash occurred and everything, I think we almost do too much of a disservice by forefronting the message and what it did, because it was just a message. People had to do things with it. And the backlash that was created to it was purposeful, and it was taking advantage of racial resentment and so many different things. But that doesn't mean that the message had to be that way. There's no essentialism to the phrase that requires people misrepresent it. When we talk about defunding, when we talk about like, it doesn't mean that you are necessarily abolishing. And I don't want to erase that some people do want to do that. Personally, I don't support that. And that could be a whole other topic, but I just think that the idea that defunding had to mean that we were going to get rid of police officers is not true. And people were intentionally misrepresenting it for that purpose. And those people are who I would want to call or hold accountable. I don't hold it against the protesters, because they don't need to do messaging. They need to get the word out. ACT UP people, which ACT UP was the protest for AIDS research, right? Because the government was ignoring a pandemic that was happening. Could you imagine? Right. So ACT UP was doing this, and they weren't being kind about it either. They were being in your face. They were being rude and crude, and it was necessary, but they didn't have so much of a backlash from the other side, because nobody wanted to be on the side of saying it's okay that people are dying. But now with Black Lives Matter, people don't have that same reticence to say that they're like not on the side of Black Lives Matter, right? So people don't have the same reticence to say that they like are against racism as it manifests in policing.
Yeah. So we're going to shift a little bit. I know we touched on this, but I think, you know, outside of what happened, and that's an important set of questions, I'm going to set you up, Dwayne, because we've had a little bit of this conversation. You know, why didn't down ballot races, Democrats do better? And what I remember from what you said, I hope it's what you remember, is like there's at least four or five or maybe more answers. They're all maybe relevant, but they also, this is maybe my spin on it, they also, each of them, when depending on how you answer this question, says a lot about your own theory of the party, theory of politics, theory of change. So do you want to talk about some of the ones I see in the chat? You mentioned them.
Yeah. Well, one of the things you just to lift up what you said was how there was a split, you know, the down ballot split when you looked at those specific races. And I want to be even a little bit more specific about it. There were many Republicans who did not vote for Trump, but every other box they checked was for a Republican. So there's not only the split of the vote, but there's the split on the Republican side. On the Democratic side, we know that down ballot is one of the worst places that we perform as Democrats. And in fact, that was exasperated when we went to vote by mail, because our messaging wasn't about vote all the way down the ballot when you vote by mail. It was about make sure you use the secrecy envelope, right? Make sure that you sign it the right way. Make sure
all naked ballots.
Oh, by the way, you actually have to vote for people too, right? Like, that was just completely and totally missed on the very first time that we had the biggest push for, like, vote by mail. That obviously had an impact.
Okay, wait, Dwayne. Being that we are now in the middle of other messaging that has complex and lots of moving parts, and I'm okay with, like, it, there were too many things. Like, even with the naked ballots, you remember, it was like, it wasn't just the ballot. You had to get it in the envelope. You had to sign the envelope. You had to not sign the other envelope. And so I agree. We missed it. But we also, we were literally trying to, like, you know, hold down all of the, you know, get our finger into all the holes in the dike and, you know, like, keep a disaster from happening.
Our trade-off was to get rid of Trump. If you think about it in those terms, that was our trade-off for that, because you're absolutely right. I'm not saying that this was like we, you know, but the ball, when you don't talk about down ballot candidates, guess who don't, they don't get votes. Like, it just doesn't happen. And that was very clear in the environment of the first time we were rolling out a very complex system of vote by mail, much more complex than in other states, you know, who don't even have a secrecy ballot, or, you know, or don't have the shifting goalposts on it. And, you know,
right. Yeah. And first time with that system. But yeah, Sam, and then, yeah, go ahead.
Well, and I mean, it is true. Act 77 got rid of straight ticket voting. So it gave us more mail in and it got rid of straight ticket. And that worked. The people who didn't want it. And that was a plan
by the Republicans to do that, to get rid of straight ticket, because they know Democrats suck at voting down ballot. So that was part of it. But the biggest thing for me, out of all of those other four or five things I mentioned, the biggest thing for me was that at the top of the ticket, you had Biden very clearly running against Trump. And you had Trump very clearly running against all Democrats, those socialist Democrats. That's what happened. And that's what happened in the messaging. And that's what carried the day. Like, if you were to talk to the average person in rural Pennsylvania, like, if they, in fact, when you were doing the telephone calls, and hopefully you were all doing the phone banking, when you tried to stay away from D's and R's, one of the first questions that someone would ask you are you a Republican or a Democrat? They want to know, because they weren't listening to what Trump was saying and not voting against Trump or voting against the Republicans, right? So I think that's the biggest one for me. That my biggest takeaway is Biden ran against Trump and Trump ran against all Democrats.
But also, that's how Biden got a bunch of Republicans to vote for him. So
and how we lost our shot at the Senate and at the House.
I agree, but it's complicated. Like, this is back to that original thing. Like, both are true. Like, yeah.
Go ahead, Nathan.
Okay, so this is kind of tangentially related to it, and it has to do with some of what we were talking about before. But I don't know if there's ever been a policy that's come from the hub, but maybe we could motion for this, and we could, like, draft some legislation, send it off to some people, and see if we can get anyone to sign on to it. How would all of you feel about having a Department of State data hub, I guess? It would be something that would be anonymized still to protect everybody's privacy, but you could actually view some of these crosstabs, because we have this stuff that's actually available to us, but we just can't use it. Like, polling can have some issues. Exit polls are pretty much useless when you have all of these vote by mails, but we have this huge source of data, and just in the name of anonymity, we don't get to take anything from it. So, like, it would be a way that we could actually have a much better understanding of the world that we're living in politically.
Are you saying that the Hub for Progress should push to get an open data hub of all this information? I just want to try to understand.
Pretty much.
Sure. It's funny to me that you said we should make a motion or something, because the hub has always been a much more organic decision-making process.
So. Well, okay. Then I'll draft some legislation myself. You know,
there you go.
I'll put my lawyer cap on that I don't own, and I'll just write something up, and we'll see if we can get someone in the hub to send it off to some people.
Let me see if I can try and recap a little bit, and then you all come in. But on this topic, I think I very much agree with what I think Dwayne said, and which is like there are multiple answers, and the answers that people like progressives and Democratic people who follow Democratic or left politics closely follow. And especially at this point, before we have all the data and analysis, the answer that you drift towards probably says a lot about your own ideas about what is the theory of the party. So some maybe haven't been said, but I feel like there's a longstanding one, which is that Democrats don't run on economic populism enough. And so they cede sort of the working class populist rhetoric. We didn't talk about that, but I think that that's one. Another is that, that Trump always runs, Republicans always run against the Democratic brand, and Democrats run against a particular candidate. And this was exacerbated this time. There were specific mechanics or procedural things, the vote by mail, the straight ticket voting, those things in Pennsylvania. The Black Lives Matter and defund the police hurt Democrats. Another one that has been on my mind is like, I first thought that maybe COVID really hurt Trump, but I wonder if maybe it didn't. Ultimately, as much as we maybe want to believe it did, because the way that this is basically shaken down as once again, sort of the moralizing bi-coastal elites telling people who have to work for a living what they should or shouldn't do, just exacerbated that kind of populist appeal for Trump himself. There may be more, but does that seem like a good list of, and I'm not saying I agree with any one of them. I'm saying that those are viable.
Those are things that people are saying for sure.
Yeah. They're saying them, but I certainly don't agree with the populism one. That one's like the worst one, because Democrats have traditionally always done that. And so, and if you look at the race class narrative, that's part of it. That's the class part of race class narrative. And it's the idea of putting those together so that you can actually have an impact on persuadables. But that's a whole nother podcast. But yeah, but I would take exception with that one.
For sure. Yeah, go ahead, Dwayne.
I was just going to say that on the last point with Trump and whether he was hurt by coronavirus, it's kind of morbid, but one of the ways that he was definitely affected by it was that
he killed his
a
own
lot
voters.
Of his voters were killed, because like generally like older people tend towards Republicans, and there are lots of exceptions to that. So I don't anyway want to say that, you know, if you're older, you're automatically voting Republican, but that would have some effect on it. And then also I do agree with you that people dug their heels in though on the other side, where they were just like, oh yeah, I'm going to be with Trump because I don't want the state telling me what to do.
I just want to point out though that it was very clear there were headlines right after the election pointing out that areas that were having surges in cases were also more likely to have voted for Trump. However, the critical thing is they hadn't died yet. The cases were rising. The deaths would lag by, you know, 3 to 4 weeks. So they have been dying since then. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Some of those ones might have been the ones who voted down ballot, but they skipped Trump because, you know, once you get the virus, it's hard to call it a hoax, I guess.
There is, Nathan, I appreciate you saying that, because it's probably hard to say definitively, but just sort of talking about this, especially in Pennsylvania, there are people who voted for Trump and then died. And the universe is big enough that probably some of them went to a Trump event and got it there. You know, I'll say that. if you thought this was an interesting, I thought it was a great discussion, and it's going to feed into the summit on, like I said, on January 3rd from 2 to 5 PM. It's all by Zoom, of course. We really will have not definitive answers on some of these, because we don't even have the data, but we will have some more clarity and information. And then we're also going to spend time with people breaking into groups and digging into this. I didn't say, and I'll use this to wrap up. I this is what I've used several times to frame the overall election results, and I find it useful, that in 2020, there was a massive blue wave, especially for Biden. And in fact, in Pennsylvania, I just looked at this, it was over 75% turnout, which is phenomenal turnout. And then there was a slightly less large red wave, and the two crashed into each other. And what we're left with, if you imagine a blue and a red wave crashing, is this choppy purple surf. And I know that you guys have heard this, but it does seem like a useful way to think about it. And I think we're in that space. And people who are trying to lean in and say, you know, that this for sure means this thing or that thing, you know, we definitely have to go this direction or that direction, they're sort of ignoring how much complexity and choppiness there is in that purple surf. Mm-hmm. Dwayne, you're muted.
Laura had a wonderful map that showed that, and yep. She's going to be showing that on yep. at the
summit.
Meeting. So once again, yep. That summit link is the bit.ly link, the www.bit.ly and this backslash hub 2021. 2021 Summit. Yep. All in lower cases.
Lowercase.
Hub 2021 Summit. And when is that, Jordy? It's from, is it 2 to 5
East Coast? 2 to 5 PM East Coast time. Yeah. And I'm gonna be Sunday, January 3rd. So this podcast really needs to get out ASAP if it's gonna make a difference. Yes, and also Dwayne is going to be featured as one of our panelists, digging in more into the narrative piece, narrative in the race class narrative as part of that. So we're going to kind of wrap up here. I think we're going to skip the New Year's resolutions. We can do that in January. I just wanted to give us a little bit of time for a couple of phrases that we've all been talking about that I think are just kind of interesting things to take and reflect on. Nathan, do you want to do the systems one?
Yeah, sure. So Michael Brooks, rest in peace. He had a quote where he said, be ruthless to systems and be kind to individuals. Sam, right? Individuals, was it?
Think to people.
Kind to people. That works too. So I think that one is something that's kind of one of my guiding philosophies in politics, where when I meet people, I try to be understanding to them. And when I'm encountering systems, they don't have a soul. I don't care. I can say whatever I want about them.
Mm-hmm. For sure. I feel like I totally agree with that. And especially in some social media spaces, the whole thing about the police, so the example I've run into recently is some people who are in the, what I call the broad left, are saying things like, the police are, class traitors. And until they point their guns the other way, they are the enemy. And I'm like, really? Like, the problem is policing, and I know that there are some bad cops, and in fact the policing system does a lot to cover up for them. I mean, just locally, we have a domestic protection order of abuse against a local officer, and that probably doesn't get revealed as much as it should. And I think two of the officers and Breonna Taylor were fired. But yeah, I don't know if other people, and I'm, of course, we'll take disagreement, but I just don't see calling all police officers pigs or whatever. I just don't think that gets us anywhere, because some of them, they got to feed their families too.
Yeah. Stephen Covey said it decades ago in his 7 Habits of Highly Effective People, that people are generally good. It's the systems that are broken. And mm-hmm. that's where we need to kind of, and that's seen throughout all kinds of like work around working with in industry and business and in commerce, that kind of thing too. Sam? Mm-hmm.
Well, and this also, it basically is setting up, the difference between, personal racism and systemic racism, right? Mm-hmm. So the system is the problem. Even when you have an actual personal racist, that one person is not really even the problem. They may be a problem in a specific situation or something like that, but what we really need to do is fix the systems, and that will move everything else along.
Right. This reminds me of one of my favorite things, this is back from the 50s, but C. Wright Mills was a sociologist, talked about the need for a sociological imagination, which is not the most artful phrase, but basically, it's the ability to understand yourself as an individual in a system. And so before we can get enough people power focused on fixing the system, I think also part of it is helping people understand that they are part of a system. I think.
Well, and just that's exactly it. If you are kind with a person, even if they're like an acute racist, some acute racists will eventually change. And they will then take on the system they were part of, but that happens not by brute force. That is change. That change happens by kindness. But the system we have to be ruthless about.
Right.
Because being kind to systems does not result in their changing.
Nathan.
Yeah. And something that Jordy focuses on a lot in a lot of his like networking talks and just because this is kind of his thing. I'm pretty sure this is like what you probably got your doctorate in, is just like this system analysis stuff. And I'm going to bastardize it, but the idea is that there are many roles and you don't have to fit all of them, but that doesn't mean that it's not valuable when people do fill those different roles. So in some ways, I think that it's good to have some people pushing the envelope on messaging. That doesn't mean that needs to be the predominant message, but having that out there, it just shows that the outrage really has teeth. If everything's just all kind, very proper, it's hard to show that it's outrageous. I mean, when people are getting killed in the streets, if you're telling the people who are being targeted in that way that they need to be kind about it, I think that that's really tone deaf. You know what I mean?
I'm glad you brought up the tone deaf, because I definitely, you know, there's different ways that for this conversation, but there's different lanes or different roles. I love that you're asking about my doctorate. It wasn't quite about that, but sure. We can talk about what it was about some other time. But, you know, I think that is something that is kind of from my academic studies is, and I mentioned this earlier, is infrastructures of people. Like, it's more important to me to make sure that we maintain these networks of people who will do the work. And, you know, I'll throw out somebody on Twitter was talking about the sort of circular firing squad habit that happens sometimes on the left. And I think all of us find that regrettable at the very least. But we were talking about ideas and people. And I said, it's important to me that we organize people and fight ideas, not the other way around. Right. Don't fight people and organize ideas, which I think, you know, is another way to maybe think about that. So the other one that I can just not get out of my head, and I don't know where it came from. I think you posted about it maybe, and that's where I saw it.
Sam posted it too. Oh, so Sam posted it too. From either one of us.
I mean, it's
circulating.
It's knowledge is sui generis, right? It just emerges from wherever. So we should all be humbled by that. But anyway, this is the phrase is that Americans are very good at acute compassion and very bad at chronic empathy or something. The acute compassion and chronic empathy is the key. I mean, I'll just say that makes so much sense to me. I think talking about COVID as a flood that's just very slow moving, which is actually something a local official who mentioned early on in the crisis, I thought was really useful. You know, when there's a flood, even on my street, Republicans and Democrats in floods that I've been through will not hesitate to help each other. But suddenly, because it's slow moving and it's acute and it involves, like Dwayne was saying earlier, a healthcare system, suddenly we don't have any empathy for all the people in it. But other people want to reflect on that one?
I do want to actually, I also did post that, and I was particularly drawn to it because of the idea of chronic empathy, because I have actually in the past year been accused of being part of the chronically concerned. And I really like that it was set against something else. So in other words, it's not that Americans, all of them, are bad at chronic empathy. There's a lot of people who do chronic empathy, and they work for social service agencies, and they volunteer, and they are very engaged in their community. And they're sort of, but they are actually seen a certain way, in particular by this other member of our conservative member of our community, as being chronically concerned, as if that were a bad thing. And I think what this encapsulation does is it points out that if you aren't into that chronic empathy, then all you have is a sort of heroic acute compassion, right? You sort of come in and do your thing, and you can only see it as something. So if it takes a gun, you'll do it. If it takes a mask, forget it. You know, it has to be framed with like, as like a crusade with, you know, armor and weapons. And it can't be, you know, something that is much more quiet and ongoing and sustainable.
I'm trying to think how the Jedi would think about this. You know, you don't always need a lightsaber. Sometimes you can just use the Force. well, any other last thoughts on either of these phrases? I think, you know, in the winter is a time of, you know, there's a certain amount of time of reflection. These are nice to have. I know as we kind of wrap up, Elijah said he wanted to revisit the cursing topic because I know that I fucking love cursing. So was there something about linguistics? anybody else? I mean, I just think the word fuck does so much work in English. I know a lot of people said this, but it's fascinating to me how much work that one word can do.
Well, what I was going to say is English is one of the only languages that we know of that has interfixing. And it only really shows up in swearing. So like we have prefixes and suffixes like ing at the end or, you know, a post
on.
Yeah. On. And when we're swearing, can I swear on this podcast?
Yes, you
are. You just
can.
Fucking did.
Yeah.
you can say like unfucking believable and it's an interfix or an infix.
Yeah. Wow. That's great.
In fix.
This is good. So maybe instead of fuck Trump, or wait, if you want your fuck Biden sign to be more effective, which I shouldn't be giving them ideas, but maybe it should be funk fuck by fuckedin, because then you actually keep the U's on the inside. So that'll be way more effective. It's going to be a really crappy sign. I hope somebody.
And no one will be able to understand it. Exactly. So awesome.
It's the benefit to me. I love it.
No, that is good. I, you know, just the thing of the sign just reminds me of this stupid minor point, but it's like Trump's nicknames sucked. They just sucked as nicknames. He was terrible. And Bush the second, who I have very little respect for, a little bit, but very little, but he was actually kind of good at it. You know, he called Karl Rove Turd Blossom. That is an amazing nickname. That is an amazing nickname. Turd Blossom.
Yes, that has an excellent vowel shift from the first word to the second one. Yes.
If I ever need to insult somebody, I'm going to run my nickname by Sam first, just to make sure that it's going to resonate with them well, and they're really going to feel it.
To bring this all the way home, and we'll probably end on this. So Elijah, our intern, also happens to be my son, and his last name legally is Zimmerman Comus. And because I'm married to an English professor, she didn't want it to be Comus Zimmerman because the Comus Zimmerman doesn't go well with Zimmerman.
Doesn't scan right.
Yeah. And my father, who is from Spain originally and generally was not much of a patriarch, lost his shit about this because it inverts the typical Mediterranean. It should have been, in Spanish tradition, Comus, the father's name, Zimmerman, just lost his shit about it and was like, thought that I was denigrating Comus. It was just a weird moment for my dad, who was very supportive of his daughter-in-law, who, you know, was getting a PhD and all of this. But anyway, I just remember, and I was trying to explain to him, but dad, it just sounds better. And he was just having none of it. So.
Yeah. I know you said you want to close on that, but that actually just reminded me, like, that kind of generational difference. It kind of teases out something that we're going to talk about next time, which is like this liberal leftist divide and all that, and how it's like inflected by generations and stuff, and how you're kind of in a really indirect way talking about that, because your idea of gender and what it requires of you, what it means to be a man, all that stuff has changed so much. And that's one of the things that comes up when you're having this debate about like the infighting or the clarification on the left.
Yeah, no, wow, Nathan, that was a pro segue to a topic I definitely think we're gonna get to. And I will admit that I have used or I've asked Elijah and some of his other friends sometimes to help be my navigator. I'm like, what exactly? How am I supposed to talk about this thing about shifting gender or whatever? And they've all been very gracious about it. But for sure, you're right. Like the ways that people my age were raised about that, regardless of my intention to be accepting, there's a lot of linguistic layers and baggage. So I think you're right. I think that those fault lines that seem left liberal, I think there's a lot of age and generational things going on there. So anyway, thanks everybody. There's probably the outro music. Anything else fun?